Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Well, folks, what is it going to take? It's now or never. You need to become, I'll just say, you need to become convinced and convicted in your perspective that you have to do this. Do you really trust government to do everything for you? Do you really believe that they have your best interest at heart? They do when it is a self-government. It can't become a self-government until you become a part of it by holding them accountable. That is your job. That is the citizen. That's the oath of the citizen. So as we kind of move forward, one of the things we want to bring into is this jurisdictional, or I should say the constitutional and legal jurisdictional limitation on the general government. Once you start understanding these little principles, and this is all founded on the ratification debates, we're going to get into some citations and so forth. So before we do that, this show is also sponsored by republicreview.org. And you're listening to the only show that goes through the academic evidence and academic evidence-based solutions. Waiting on the We the People Foundation to let us know when they're going to be talking about the importance of the lawsuit that they're doing and what the heck's going on. I have no idea why it's taking so long. I mean, you don't want to basically, you know, announce 2 days in, you know, advance. You want to have, when you want to have a big movement, you want to have, you know, a big event, you got to make that, you got to schedule that and let everybody know well in advance. We're going to be doing, like Red Pill Expo, they do it months in advance to say, we're going to do this. You got to start planning, and you got to actually say, okay, next week we're going to have a meeting. And then you live to that schedule. And then you say, the following week we're going to have this meeting. You start creating the meetings, you start creating the schedule, then everybody else can schedule with you. But until it's scheduled, you're taking a crap shot that you're going to create conflicts. It's kind of like when we manage parties and everything else around Christmas time. Do you wait until the week of the party for Christmas to say, we're going to have a Christmas party on Thursday? On Monday? You tell people on Monday you're having a party on Thursday? 9 times out of 10, those parties have already been, all the other parties have been scheduled months in advance. We're going to have our, you know, our neighborhood Christmas party at the community center on this day, because you want to schedule it, because individuals will be using the same venue, resources, and so forth. My point is you have to just start drawing the line and saying, these are the days we're going to do this. It's going to be Tuesday. Boom, boom, boom. Now, you can easily be caught up in data calls. You know, well, what's best for everybody? Start, and then when everybody realizes if we shift the day, instantly we start realizing that a Saturday morning becomes the best time of the day to do something. Now, just to be clear, you need to start getting far more involved than just these little things. You need to push yourself to the limits, because I'm telling you, when you're fighting a war, you don't just, you know, meander and go up to the window to hold the gun out and bang, bang, bang and just shoot, right? You want to make every shot count. You want to make sure everything you're doing is actually killing the enemy and or, you know, winning the battle. You don't lackadaisically execute a battle. If not, if you do that, then you will die. So you have to start really looking at what you're doing and focused on doing those things. This is why you have to start scheduling and getting organized and not living to, you know, or I should say, not constraining yourself or being sucked into this never-ending swirl, like, a, you know, this whirlpool that you could become trapped in identifying. You know, what is best? What's the best day? What's the best time? It'll take you months before you have a meeting. We don't have that time, folks. Start doing it. Start getting it scheduled. So, Bob's seminar is coming up. Hopefully, he'll give us some lead time. As soon as I know, you will know. Gary Smith, Fortitude Financial Coaching. Call him. Reach out to him. He is available. His link is out on our website. So just reach out to Gary and connect with him. He will help you. ConstitutionEducation.us for constitutional content at this point in time. Timber Nation, timbernation.com, hardwood furnishings, radio dust covers, protect your electronics. You know, these are personal endorsements. I could do these or I couldn't do these. But I believe that these guys are patriots. I believe that these guys could really use your support. And the money that they make is actually helping other people. They get involved. They use their, I'm not going to say these are philanthropist organizations, but they at least do support. They understand the importance of applying their principle, their capital towards good, worthy causes. Stan Kluett at Radio Dust Covers is one of those people. Ad Local is definitely a company that does that. That's the only reason why I'm endorsing these companies, because I know that these people, I know what they're doing, and they're actually contributing, and they help. They've given me information, and you know, they didn't do it with this, you know, intent or this dangled promise, hey, I'll endorse you if you help me out. That was never the case. I've never asked anybody for a break or a benefit. Actually, I have to recant that. With Ad Local, I did talk to them, and I said, what does it cost? But I never asked them to do anything for free, and that's where Ben is at. Ben has really, he believes in Republic Review. He recognizes that these are the actual solutions, and so he's that's why he's getting behind this, and he wants to help you as well. But none of these people can do this at a loss. They have to be able to at least make their money and be able to cover their costs and so forth. So anywho, it's great being able to work with patriots, because then we can actually start visualizing and actualizing successes, because we're getting the support we need, because we actually have the services and those essential things that actually help make that thing happen. More specifically, Ad Local can provide you the ISP support, and that is the root of your communications base, your information, content, and those types of things. Do not marginalize the importance of having that presence, because almost everybody relies upon web-based content, web-based, you know, communications, and so forth, whether that be email or push RSS feeds, what have you. As a matter of fact, yours truly, I'm going to start getting RSS feeds, and we're going to start putting our content out so that every time our show is done and uploaded, you will receive the notice on the weekly basis when we upload those things, when that stuff happens. So let me move forward. We have a comment line, 425-270-5416, and as we were just ending our show on yesterday, our last episode yesterday, we started saying and introducing to you this concept of constitutional and legal. It's synonymous, so it's a little redundant. When I say constitutional jurisdiction, that basically means the actual legal, the supreme law of the land, the limitation, the legal limitations of jurisdiction on the general government. So the title being constitutional and legal jurisdiction, our jurisdictional limitation on the general government. So let me just dive forward into this, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to read you this article, and it's important because there may be my parts of this, but these arguments that I've created are all supported by these citations that are in this. Okay, so this is the introduction. There is a legal and symbiotic relationship between the constitutional doctrines of the equal footing, enumerated constitution, states' rights, the uniformity clause, and fundamental contract law. Never in the history of state sovereignty has a state stood united on these aforementioned doctrines and tenets. Now, when we go back to the Kentucky resolutions, when we go back to the Virginia resolutions, they never used these tenets, because at that point in time, the federal government really wasn't attacking them on the equal footing, uniformity, and those types of things. But all of these things actually create this symbiotic tie in amplifying your defense against federal tyranny. So moving on, uniting these five into the argument for a full state sovereignty will pave the way for almost all states in one capacity or another to begin working together in taking back their constitutional roles, responsibilities, and powers. That was the introduction. the Equal Footing Doctrine and the Uniformity Clause, in accordance with Article 4, Section 3, Subsection 1 of the Constitution, Congress has the responsibility, in other words, not a power. This is a responsibility to admit new states into the Union. See, the difference is a power is something that they have discretion over. There's a power is where they can start, you know, creating laws to enforce that power. So, the power to call forth the militia, how they do that and how that's to be done. Congress has that power to call forth the militia. They do not have the power to give that to the president. For the president to receive that power, Congress must amend the Constitution. And this was one of the big problems in 1792, where Congress actually granted that in one very specific case, but it became a standard which was unconstitutional. In the case of the Whiskey Rebellion, it was clear that Congress, you know, actually was trying to call forth the militia to do that, but the president wasn't ready. So to answer the problem, they basically said, when you're ready to call upon the militia, we will give you DLOA, or direct liaison authorization. In other words, you don't need to come through Congress to call forth the militia to execute these laws. You, as the president, for this one specific case, can go and do this. And they had the ability to do that over that one problem, but they can't carte blanche abdicate the responsibility in calling forth the militia and granting that to the president. Anyway, we'll be right back after these two promos.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're diving into what was called the Equal Footing Doctrine, because the Equal Footing Doctrine was the actual words used in the enabling acts of these new states, Kentucky, Tennessee, New Hampshire, and so forth. And so, as I just read, in accordance with Article 4, Section 3, Subsection 1 of the Constitution, Congress has the responsibility, not the power, to admit new states into the Union. Congress did not receive any power whatsoever in this portion of the Constitution, nor in any amendment to the Constitution, to admit states into the Union with varying degrees of sovereignty or burdens placed upon a state that was not applied to all states. In accordance with Article 1, Section 8
of the preamble of the enumerated powers. Congress has the power to, quote, lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. In other words, the only burden that Congress can put upon the states are these taxes. So where did they list that they could actually start taxing states by taking away their resources to make them national resources? In other words, shoot, look at it this way. If the federal government had the authority and the power to take the forests away from states so that they could harvest that, so they could sell that timber, so that they could create revenue, that is a form of taxation. Anytime the federal government takes away a resource, whether the state is using it or whether the federal government is not using it, you have restricted and made and taken away from the state the ability to make their own revenue off of those things. Whether that be the minerals under the ground, whether that be the trees, whether that be the agricultural land, it does not matter. The federal government, first off, you got to remember, we have these enumerated constitution, but more importantly, where was the power delegated where the federal government could meddle within any of the resources of a state? Once a state is established, it has the sovereignty over every square inch of land. The only time, and we'll get into this with the enumeration, and the enumeration portions of the Constitution, the only time the federal government can actually come in and take land from the state is for those enumerated roles, responsibilities, and powers. So anyway, therefore, going back into this subsection, therefore, the general government must deal and treat with each state uniformly and equally. The states have not delegated any power to the general government to allow them to create unequal burdens, taxes, or hardships upon the states and their resources. The equal footing doctrine and principle was evident in the admission of the enabling acts of Kentucky, Tennessee, Vermont, and so forth. The next subsection is the enumerated constitution, states' rights, and the fundamental contract law. So, first off, we've laid out this case of fact of equal footing doctrine and uniformity, that those two doctrines go together. Now we're tying in the enumerated constitution, state rights, and fundamental contract law. In accordance with Article 7 of the Constitution is a compact, and the only, quote, parties to the compact are the states who ratified the Constitution. And each state that has been admitted to the Union, which is why all states must possess equal footing and sovereignty. During the ratification debates of the Constitution, the original 13 states were emphatically told that the jurisdiction of the general government was limited to the enumerated powers within the Constitution. Keep in mind, the primary argument the Anti-Federalists used was the fact that the Constitution lacked a Bill of Rights. The reason this argument was rejected and why states actually ratified the Constitution was due to the fact that the Constitution granted no general powers, that the powers were enumerated and were defined to be specific. As those states vigorously debated the Constitution, the insights into the fundamental contract law became very clear. There are two ways powers can be delegated in a Constitution. In other words, the Constitution is a compact between the parties, which consisted of the states only, as Jefferson and Madison stated. Those two methods are either in general powers or clearly delineated, similar to powers of attorney, in other words, general or enumerated. The Constitution of the United States possesses no general powers. There are two preambles which were contained and defined by granting no powers during the ratification debates. In other words, during the ratification debates, when they said, hey, this general welfare clause right there, that sure comes across as a general power, it was clarified that that is not granting any general power. So with that legal term and definition that was granting no general power, down the road, you can't all of a sudden make something out of something that wasn't defined that way, especially in the legal course. This is why the ratification debates are legal definitions and why we have to apply them, because that's how it was sold to the states. You can't say one thing and then down the road say, oh, well, yeah, that's not what we meant. Because in contract law, you can't change the terms and definitions without actually going through and amending the compact or the contract, you know, and in this case, the Constitution. So anyway, thus granting no powers of the ratification debates, thus based on the clarifications of the compact during the ratification debates, these definitions, terms, and conditions that were stipulated in the ratification debates are legally binding terms and definitions to the compact, just like I said. Here are six principal and primary examples of the Federalists' arguments that were used and accepted during the ratifying of the Constitution, limiting the general government to what was enumerated within the Constitution, thus limiting their jurisdiction to those powers and property enumerated. Now, all of these citations are coming out of the ratification debate. So we're going to give you, as we talk about definitizing the Constitution, these are the legally binding terms and definitions, footnotes. When you look at a legal document, you can create a footnote to that clause to actually point to exactly how that clause was explained legally during the legal acceptance process, which makes that term and definition legally binding. Okay, so this one is from the North Carolina debates. The gentleman has wandered out of his way, and the person that's stating this is Mr. McLean. The general has wandered out of his way to tell us what has so often been said out of doors, that there is no Declaration of Rights, that consequently all our rights are taken away. It would be a very extraordinary to have a Bill of Rights, because powers of Congress are expressly defined, and the very definition of them is valid and efficacious, a check as a Bill of Rights. In other words, as effective of a check as a Bill of Rights could be without the dangerous implications of a Bill of Rights. The reason why the Bill of Rights were identified as dangerous is because they were pointing to the fact that you couldn't list everything. So technically, folks, I'm going on a tangent here. We've technically got the best of both worlds, because with this enumerated Constitution, the only way the federal government could do anything was by the granting of power. It didn't matter whether we had a Bill of Rights or not. However, the fact that we created a Bill of Rights was become very applicable when it came to the states and the Civil War, because the Bill of Rights was just extra declaratory restrictions placed on the federal government. They were unnecessary because, again, if there's no mention of the press, if there's no mention of religion, speech, assembly, First Amendment petitions, then the federal government can't manipulate or meddle in those things. I will say the First Amendment petition was actually pretty instrumental, and it was the one thing that was being exercised by the people for quite a while, and it was until after the Civil War where government started recognizing, you know what, we need to ignore these things. We need to actually change the paradigm. So that people can't exercise, or we're not going to recognize. We need to get to a point where we can convince them that we don't recognize this and that they have another mechanism. This is why protests have been sold for decades as your constitutional right, and why nobody has been teaching you this constitutional power called the First Amendment petition. So anyway, when we look at the enumerated powers and the Bill of Rights, the Bill of Rights really didn't play as a significant of a role in liberty in America until the states, after the Civil War, the 14th Amendment applied the Bill of Rights, or the privileges and immunities protected by the Constitution, which included the Bill of Rights, upon the states. This really makes some, what we would call some quasi-constitutionalist, you know, they get all up in arms because they think that the Bill of Rights, you know, completely takes away the sovereignty of the states. No, they're very specific. the Bill of Rights are very, very specific. And why, if we have those things protected, those rights protected from the state governments, why is that a bad thing? Because technically, the state governments have way too many general powers. We need to get through and dend those and get rid of all of these general powers that the states have. If there are to be any general powers, which I'm not an advocate for, any general powers or most powers that can be executed and exercised should be done at the county level. The place where you can actually get in your car, drive, you know, an hour or less to the county seat and say, what business do you have of doing these things and holding them accountable? It gets harder and harder as you start moving those powers and controls away from you. We'll be right back with this article after this, after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL. Or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, so the reason I just went down this tangent on the Bill of Rights and this very specific citation, because during the ratification debates, the anti-federalists kept on saying, we have to have a Bill of Rights, we have to have a Bill of Rights. And I'm telling you, that the Bill of Rights were important, but we didn't realize, they didn't know that we needed a Bill of Rights because of the Civil War that was going to come, and that we needed states to be able to hold them accountable. I'll tell you what, there have been plenty of people that are perverting both sides of this issue, and what we need to do is we need to really look at, again, you know, the upstream paradigm of do we trust implicitly government? We should never implicitly trust government. State governments that can actually create general powers, we need bills of rights at the state. We don't really need a Bill of Rights at the federal level. The only reason that we actually had the Bill of Rights at the federal level, I truly believe, other than the petitioning and some of these other little things, but never really, there's never any big problems case-wise where the government got out of hand in taking away the rights of the people. The federal government didn't, at least right out the gate. I mean, well, obviously, they started with this Alien Sedition Act, but I honestly think that those types of things were necessary trial runs so that we could actually see what to do, because the Lord gave us the views of what could happen and then what we should do, such as the 1798 resolutions, which is why we get into those in detail and we read through those. But let me get back to the citation from Mr. McLean. And let me start all over, and I'm not going to go into a tangent. I'm just going to read it, but I want you to understand, every time they're bringing up this Bill of Rights, they're pointing out the flawed concept of what a Bill of Rights really is. But what they have created and what they're selling in the ratification debates is an enumerated constitution. And that's what the whole point of these citations are in this document, that these are the only things they have jurisdiction over. They can't just grant themselves jurisdiction. Anyway, the gentleman has wandered out of his way to tell us what has so often been said out of doors, that there is no Declaration of Rights, that consequently all our rights are taken away. It would be very extraordinary to have a Bill of Rights because powers of Congress are expressly defined, and the very definition of them is as valid and efficacious a check as a Bill of Rights could be without the dangerous implication of a Bill of Rights. The powers of Congress are limited and enumerated. We say we have given them those powers, but we do not say we have given them more. We retain all those rights which we have not given away to the general government. The gentleman is a professional man. If a gentleman had made his last will and testament and devised or bequeathed to a particular person the sixth part of his property or any particular specific legacy, could it be said that that person should have the whole estate? If they assume powers not enumerated, there was no occasion for enumerating any powers. The gentleman is learned. Without recurring to his learning, he may only appeal to his common sense. It will inform him that if we had all power before and give away but a part, we still retain the rest. That was Mr. McLean on July 28th of 1798 in North Carolina. This next one is another North Carolina debate. This is Mr. Iredell. He is, as far as I'm concerned, as a ratification debates federalist. Some of his arguments are absolutely some of the best, and this is one of my favorites. Did any man ever hear before that at the end of a power of attorney, it was said that the attorney should not exercise more power than that what is there given? Suppose, for instance, a man had lands in the counties of Anson and Coswell, and he should give another a power of attorney to sell his lands in Anson. Would the other have authority to sell the lands in Coswell? Or could he without absurdity say, 'Tis true, you have not expressly authorized me to sell the lands in Coswell, but as you had lands there and did not say I should not, I thought I might as well sell those lands as the other.' A Bill of Rights, as I conceive, would only be the incongruous would not only be incongruous, but dangerous. No man, let his ingenuity be what it will, could enumerate all the individual rights not relinquished by this Constitution. So why even go down that path of trying when they've, I'm adding here, why go down that path of trying when they've already enumerated and defined exactly what those powers are and how they could be used? Okay, so the next one, and this is Mr. Wilson out of Pennsylvania. Whoever views the matter in a true light will see that the powers are minutely enumerated and defined as was possible, and will also discover that the general clause against which so much exception is taken is nothing more than that was necessary to render effectual the particular powers that are granted. There you go. So they're all saying the exact same thing. They're just putting it in a different way. Madison is the most succinct, and it's the shortest citation out of the six. Quote, the powers of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. That was on June 6th, 1787. Or actually 1788, my bad. In England, in all disputes between the king and the people, now this is Mr. Nicholas, I love this, This is really right down to it. He talks a little bit about the Bill of Rights and the enumerated and so forth, but he comes down to this real contrast and comparison between a general powers Bill of Rights and enumerated powers without Bill of Rights. He says, in England, in all disputes between the king and people, recurrence is had to the enumerated rights of the people to determine, are the rights in dispute secured? Are they included in the Magna Carta, Bill of Rights, and etc.? If not, they are, generally speaking, within the king's prerogative. In disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? If not, Congress cannot meddle with it. See the brilliance in just these short little definitions of identifying what these powers are and what the jurisdiction limitation is of the federal government. That was June 10th, 1788. And so if they were to make a law, this is John Marshall now, out of the Virginia. So the last three were Virginias. If they were to make a law not warranted by any of the powers enumerated, it would be considered by the judges as an infringement of the Constitution, which they are to guard. They would not consider such a law as coming under their jurisdiction. They would declare it void. And so what he's basically saying is that the Supreme Court, when they recognize, or the federal court system's buried, they'll say, hey, we have no jurisdiction because this issue is not within the enumerated powers. Well, they stopped doing that as soon as John Marshall got to the bench. In other words, what John Marshall said was he said the technical, legally correct issue here in the ratification debates. When he then contradicted himself as the Supreme Court justice, he was lying and being deceptful in assuming powers, and nobody held him accountable to it. Technically, some of these men should have been hanged by their throats. Anyway, let me move on to the next part of this argument for the judicial or the jurisdictional limitations here. The reason why the terms and definitions provided to the states during the ratification debates are legally binding is because these terms and definitions were what sold the states into accepting the Constitution without a Bill of Rights. This is a fundamental tenet in contract law. In 1821, James Madison pointed to this fundamental tenet when he was asked by John G. Jackson to release his notes on the Constitutional Convention of 1787 so that people could understand the Constitution in contrast to some of the verdicts coming from the federal courts. This is what Madison stated in his response to John G. Jackson asking for his notes. He said, but whatever might have been the opinions entered in forming the Constitution, it was that, because he basically says, you can't have my notes. I'm not going to give you my notes. But whatever might have been the opinions entertained in forming the Constitution, it was the duty of all to support it in its true meaning as understood by the nation at the time of its ratification. No one felt this obligation more than I have done, and there are few, perhaps, whose ultimate and deliberate opinions on the merits of the Constitution accord in a greater degree with that obligation. In other words, he's saying there are very few people out there that are taking these things as literal, in literal context, as I am. And that's why he kind of pointed, hey, this is where you need to go. You need to go to the ratification debates to understand the Constitution. Because that's how it was sold. That is the legal framework of how that Constitution is to be operated and how the general government of the states are to hold that general government accountable to those definitions and terms. Okay, we got a break coming in. So more importantly, this is what we'll pick up with when we come back from the break. I'm hoping this is starting to make sense. And so what we're doing is we're creating this relationship, again, to the equal footing doctrine, as well as the uniformity clause, or that uniformity doctrine, and now to these enumerated powers of what powers they absolutely possess that they can operate on. And we'll be moving forward in this argument right after this.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I'm trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's kind of get back into some meat, because I'm hoping that you enjoy the meat, hearing what the facts really are, because I truly believe, remember what I said in our previous episode, that there are always three sides to every story, his, hers, and the facts. And what we all want are the facts. Now, again, this article may have some of my biases, but I am doing everything I possibly can to present the facts to you on what the federal government's jurisdictions are. And so, really, this doesn't have a lot of personal, you know, there's nothing here that benefits me. I mean, I'm not even selling this article. Now, what I probably will do is I'm going to kind of combine all of these articles down the road to make a book. And I'll probably do, you know, I'll do this as a self-publishing thing. So if you want to buy the book, then you'll actually have it. You can have that, and that'd be great. But that's really more of something for my legacy, just because. So just so you understand, and I've mentioned this before, and I'm going down this tangent. We'll get back into the content in a minute. With my lung disease, my plan was, because I've been a very healthy person, I've lived a good life, and I've actually lived a healthy life, trying not to expose myself, you know, to cancerous causing things, trying to live, you know, keep my body clean and so forth. So it was a big shock a year ago to find out that I had a lung disease. More importantly, I was right at that point in time where I started, you know, executing the plan of, you know, getting my weight and becoming the optimum health so that I could go out and get myself a decent life insurance so that if something did happen to me that, you know, I would expire before my wife, she would have more than enough to be able to take care of her without, you know, her having to live a burden because of her inabilities. Because when you get older, you just can't go out and you can't make money. It's really harder and harder and harder for as you get to a certain age. And so you have to have a retirement plan. So that was my retirement plan. And the fact is that because we have spent the money out of my retirement, or I've been spending money out of my retirement without taking it from our current revenue streams and so forth, we've been able to get by with that. But now I've kind of stolen from Peter to pay Paul. And so my book sales and some of the things that we're going to do in monetizing, the intent is just to really to pay that back and to create that
financial bubble for my wife. Because currently, until we get a different diagnosis, I have maybe 3 to 5 years left. That's the statistics that I'm looking at. And so that becomes very alarming. I've got to do something about that. Plus, we're already running out of time and I need to grow this message. So that's why we'll talk more about monetizing Reclaiming the Republic and making Reclaiming the Republic a tool for you to use, but not for you to create a Reclaiming the Republic organization, but for you to help you support your unorganized militia and how to do this and so forth. So we'll talk more details about that. But the whole point is that, you know, what we're trying to do here is give you the facts. And I'm, you know, when I talk about writing a book or publishing a book, the only reason that these things are going to exist is really kind of like Madison. And that's why I was kind of bringing this out. Madison's notes on the Constitution, his view was to save those as a posthumous product. So he basically had these things prepared and done by the time he was to pass so that Dolly Madison could take them to print his document and be able to make money, because he knew that she would be able to make, you know, some money and support herself off of his work as a retired. That was his retirement plan. That was his retirement scheme, to have this one document help fund that. Well, Madison wasn't necessarily the best businessman. He had a beautiful legal mind. I mean, this guy was practical in all different ways, but he probably overestimated the value of his notes. And he probably should have actually done more work in putting publications together and so forth, so that Dolly Madison would have been able to print all sorts of things that would have been written by him that would have been great guides for all of us. I mean, I hear lots of people talk about his notes on the convention. They're very insightful, just like the Federalist Papers were. But this was something very specific that he was doing to basically help his wife, because he knew that she would need help. Because when you're in that frail point in your life, you're the most vulnerable. And unfortunately, we're vulnerable to government, and government has taken a very hostile view towards the elderly, the infirm, and so forth. I mean, that's what you're not paying them any money, because you're not like you're out there making taxes and revenue. You become more of a burden. And that's an evil society that takes those types of views. But anyway, I'm just giving you some insight. Now, let's move forward here. More importantly, in 1800, after James Madison and Thomas Jefferson attempted to unite the states on interposing full compliance to their compact, Mr. Madison expounded on the point, in fact, as to who the parties were in stating, quote, "Founded in common sense, illustrated by common practice, and essential to the nature of compacts, that where resort can be had to no tribunal superior to the authority of the parties themselves must be the rightful judges." In other words, the Supreme Court cannot be the superior party because they are the inferior. They're going to do everything they can to aggrandize themselves, to make them more greater and more powerful and have more supremacy over things than they should have, at the expense of the estate, at the expenses of the state. He gets into this. This is from his notes, or not his notes, his report on the Virginia Resolutions of 1800. Anyway, getting back to what I was saying, the parties themselves must be the rightful judges in the last resort, whether the bargain made, or that compact is the bargain, made has been pursued or violated. The Constitution of the United States was formed by the sanction of the states, given by each in its sovereign capacity. It adds to the stability and dignity, as well as to the authority of the Constitution, that it rests on this legitimate and solid foundation. The states, then, being the parties to the constitutional compact and in the sovereign capacity, it follows the necessity that there can be no tribunal above their authority to decide in the last resort whether the compact made by them be violated, and consequently that as the parties to it, they must themselves decide in the resort, in the last resort, such questions as may be sufficient magnitude to require their interposition. It does not follow, however, because the states as sovereign parties to their constitutional compact must ultimately decide whether it has been violated, that such a decision ought to be interposed either in a hasty manner or on doubtful and inferior occasions. In other words, you really don't want to do interposition over all these little teeny issues, you know, like that person, you know, has a represent a repugnant lifestyle or what have you. Even in the case of ordinary conventions between different nations or agreements and standards, whereby the strict rule of interpretation, a breach of a part may be deemed a breach of the whole. Every part being deemed a condition of the every other part of the whole, it is always laid down that the breach must be both willful and material. Well, I'm telling you, folks, do you think that what the federal government is doing in violating the Constitution, assuming all these powers and using them as weapons against us, do you think that's one willful and material? You bet it is. Madison goes on and says, to justify an application of the rule. But in the case of an intimate and constitutional union like that of the United States, it is evident that the interposition of the parties in their sovereign capacity can be called by occasions only deeply and essentially affecting the vital principles of their political system. In other words, we absolutely have to do this if we are going to survive. Interposition is the only way. In this same report, Madison even pointed to the fact that the judiciary could not be the final arbiters regarding violations committed by the general government in stating, quote, but it is objected that the judicial authority be to be regarded as the sole expositor of the Constitution in the last resort. And it may be asked for what reason the declaration by the General Assembly, supposing it to be theoretically true, could be required at the present day and in so a solemn manner. On this objection, it might be observed first that there may be instances of usurped power which forms the Constitution would never draw within the control of the judicial department. Secondly, that if the decision of the judiciary be raised above the authority of the sovereign parties to the Constitution, the decisions of the other departments not carried by the forms of the Constitution before the judiciary must be equally authoritative and final with the decisions of that department. But the proper answer, so he's just kind of giving you some, you know, basic answers, but the proper answer to this objection is that the resolution of the General Assembly relates to those great and extraordinary cases which all the forms of the Constitution may prove ineffectual against infractions dangerous to the essential rights of the parties to it. The resolution supposes that the dangerous powers not delegated may not only be usurped and executed by the other departments, but the judicial department also may exercise sanctions and or dangerous powers beyond the grant of the Constitution. And there it is. If they can get their foot through the door, they will, just like the camel's nose in the tent, they will take over. You cannot allow them in that room. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we'll be back with the rest of this tomorrow in our next episode. God bless. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process.
This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.